Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Chav Zayin Amud Bet by the Mishnah, which is no dream the haragin ule haramin ule mochsin shehi truma afal pi sheinu truma shein shel beit hamelech afal pi sheinan shel beit hamelech. So the individuals can take a neder in order to say that the objects in his house are either truma or they belong to the king, even though neither of those statements are true. Now he's saying them to these individuals who are coming to take the money from him, to take his possessions from him. Haragin, the way that the Farshim explained over here, the haragim are people who kill if you don't give them the money that they want. The most dangerous of the group over here. The Ran notes over here that they are listim Israel. These are Jewish thieves that we're speaking about over here. Because the fact that they respect Truma shows you that it must be someone who is Jewish, that Truma means something to them. Ule Haramin, these are thieves that take everything. They don't kill, but they will wipe you out. The Listim, marauders of some sort that take everything out. And the Mochsim are tax collectors. So all these individuals are coming to take money or take away your possessions. So the individual, in order to protect his possessions, takes a neder that his possessions are really Truma, or that his possessions belong to the king, even though neither of those statements are true. So, interesting number of things that come out of this. Number one is the fact that his saying that it's truma, or his saying that it belongs to the king, makes a difference to those individuals. Now, saying it belongs to the king, that's one thing. That might make a difference, and that might make a difference even for non-Jewish marauders or individuals who come to steal. But saying Truma is only true by people who are thieves or Israelim, why would this stop them stealing and killing? Say it's Truma, all of a sudden they back off. So that's what the Rosh says over here. It's a very important principle, and I said I would speak about it when we got to the Mishnah. He says, Afagav, the katle v'gazle, lo achle isura. Even though they kill, they steal, they won't eat isur. Inami, en nechsha b'enem, ki b'damim mu'atim iknu harbe Truma. Or it's just not worth it to them. Because Truma, they can buy out on the open market for cheap prices, because it's something only Kohanim can eat. And if they really wanted to get Truma, it's not worth the effort to steal to get Truma, because you can buy it at such discounted prices. But according to the first answer of the Rosh, which seems to be the simplest understanding of this Mishnah, they are basically willing to back off of Truma. They're willing to back off if it's Hekdesh. But they don't worry about killing and stealing. And so that here he says that many people have this, that they won't eat Isura, they won't get involved in Isur, but killing and stealing does not do it for them. This Mishnah really is talking about very similar to the Haftorah that we read on Shabbat Chazon, the first parak in Yishayahu, which talks about God says, I don't want your korbanot anymore. I don't want what you're offering me because you're killing, you're stealing, and then you're coming and bringing your korbanot. In that you're makpid on your ben adam lemakom, but you're not makpid on your ben adam lechaviro. There's no such thing. There's no such thing as worshiping God if you don't take care of your ben adam lechaviro, like the pasuk in Yirmiyahu says in Perek Tet of Yirmiyahu, that what Hashem really wants is that a person does chesed, stoko, umishpat, to be domel Hashem. Those are the things that matter to Hashem, to do those things. Now obviously, there are also rules, ben adam lemakom. It's not just ben adam lechaviro, but we see throughout Chazal that there's a big difference between ben adam lechaviro and ben adam lemakom. Then when it comes to ben adam lemakom, Hashem is much, much lighter in terms of his punishment versus ben adam lechaviro, where Hashem takes out his full wrath, evidence of that in Parshat Noach, where by the Mabul, they were destroyed entirely because it was ben adam lechaviro. And that by the Migdal Bavel, where it was Ben Adam Makom, Hashem just dispersed them and did not destroy them because they were united in their front and they worked together. And it wasn't a problem Ben Adam Lechaviro, it was only a problem Ben Adam Makom. And so we see that imbalance that has happened so often, and the Mishnah is here describing exactly this imbalance or this problem that exists, that there's too much emphasis on Ben Adam the makom, and not an emphasis on ben adam lechaviro. As what Chazal said to us, the second Beit HaMikdash was destroyed over sinat chinam. They were talmidei chachamim. They kept the mitzvot. They were religious people. But there was sinat chinam. They didn't treat each other properly. They didn't interact properly. And this Mishnah is evidence of that type of behavior, which is that people are killing and stealing. You say it's truma, and they hands off. They won't touch it anymore. That's a crazy situation that you can kill, but you won't eat truma, you won't violate certain isurim. And that's what I mentioned earlier about the concept of kol nidrei. That saying kol nidrei before Yom HaKippurim really was this idea of focusing on the ben adam, the chaveru aspect that many of the nidarim, or most of the nidarim that we bump into over here, show this mistaken emphasis on ben adam l'makom. And ben adam l'chaveru, they're taking these nidarim and they're not treating each other properly, and it's all based on this fight and improper relationships that are going on, that are people are taking nidarim. And kol nidrei is a reminder to us that we have to also take into consideration ben adam l'chaveru and the emphasis of ben adam l'chaveru, and not be like this Mishnah, where everything's about ben adam l'makom and ben adam l'chaveru gets pushed by the wayside. Now, Beit Shammai omrim, v'chol ha-nodrim chutz mi bishvuah, that you can do this with a nether, but not through a shvuah. Right, we'll get to it in the Gemara, exactly what the shvuah is, or the nature of the shvuah. But basically what they say is, you can do this through a nether and not a shvuah, because shvuah is more chamir. It's more chamur, because it says, lo yinakeh by a shvuah. So if you're going to lie, and lie through a nether, or lie through a shvuah, we'd rather you lie through a nether than lie through a shvuah. Beit Hillel omrim, af bishvuah. Beit Hillel says, it's fine, use a nether, use a shvuah. Either way, works. Beit Shammai omrim, lo yiftach lo b'neder, that he shouldn't open up with a nether. He shouldn't volunteer that he'll take a nether. But if they ask him to take a nether, then he takes it. He says, that's truma. So they'll say to him, take a nether, that it's truma, then fine. They can respond with a nether. He shouldn't say, with a nether, open up, that is truma. Beit Hillel omrim, af iftochlo. And Beit Hillel says, you can even open. You can make that your opening salvo to the thieves, to tell them, I'm taking a nether, that is truma. Beit Shammai omrim, bameshu madiro. That Beit Shammai says you should always respond to what he's asking for. If they want a nether, only respond to the nether with what they want. Don't expand the nether to beyond what they want. Beit Hillel omrim, af b'mashenu mediro. Even things that they didn't ask for, to reinforce, to establish the veracity of his statement, he can say whatever he wants. Ketzad. Amar lo amur konam ishti nenet li. The thieves, marauders, these killers, say to him, say that your wife will not get any anah from you if this is not truma. Bamar konam ishti ubanai nenimli. And he throws in his children as well. He added in those additional individuals, obviously for reinforcement, but he's adding it in. So then, Beit Shammai omrim ishto muteret banav asurim. That his wife is muteret because they asked for it. His children are asurim because they didn't ask for that. That means he did it voluntarily. Beit Hillel omrim elu veilu mutarim. They're both mutar because it's under the same rubric here of the problematic neder that he's taking here. And therefore, even when he adds in his children, that doesn't change the facts. As we've seen all along here, the Beit Hillel says you can volunteer information, you can do this of your own volition, and it's not a problem. And so too over here. Now, even though generally Beit Hillel says neder shehutar miksato hutar kulo, so it wouldn't have mattered either way. Because if his wife wasn't included, that'd be neder shehutar miksato hutar kulo, even the part on his children should be wiped out. It might be that it's different over here, and why Beit Hillel has to make their statement is because generally we're talking about a neder shehutar miksato hutar mechlalo is a case where the entire neder has some feasibility of taking effect. Over here, the neder vis-a-vis his wife is meaningless. Because over there, that's what they asked for, and we clearly know he's lying. Maybe that's not called neder shehutar miksato, because that miksat was not even a neder. So then the other part that's about his children, you could have argued is a full neder, and what happens with his wife has nothing to do with what happens with his children. So Beit Hillel comes along to tell you that elu ve'elu mutarim, that both these instances, they are mutar. So now, what's this mission have to do with our perek? According to most, and I mentioned this before, with the content to nidrei shkigogot, here this is nidrei on a sin, which is that there are two types of onus that can take place. There's onus that can take place which stops you from being mekayim the neder, which was the previous Mishnah. And then there is an onus that is an onus in the duress that was placed on you to take the neder, that the neder was under duress, and therefore that is also something that will remove the need to have a petach the neder, because there's an automatic dissolution of the neder because of the fact that it was taken under duress. So that's why this Mishnah is connected to the previous Mishnah and connected to our perek, is because of that idea that you have multiple manifestations of onus. Onus which prevents you from doing the kiyum nether. Onus which is at the time of the nether, you're under duress and that caused the problem in the nether. Now the Gemara asks a very simple question, a question that has reverberations throughout the halacha, which is, over here it named three different people who are coming to collect. It named the haragin, which are killers, the Haramin, or these marauders of sort, these thieves, and then Muhsin, tax collectors. The Gemara says, what's wrong with the tax collector coming to collect? Why are you allowed to lie to the tax collector? V'amar Shmuel, Dina, Demachuta Dina, that when it comes to the law of the land, you have to abide by the law of the land. How is it possible that you are somehow trying to escape paying taxes, which is the law of the land? Amar of Chinina, Amar of Kana, Amar Shmuel, B'mocheis, She'in lo kitzva. We're talking about a mocheis that has no limit to his collection. Now, why does that necessarily change the din? So Tosafot of Iras, Yesh Lamar, She'kevin she'in derech mocheisim kach, Ein ze dino, elegzela shel mocheis atzmo. So even though technically maybe he bought that right from the king to collect as much as he can, as much as he can extract from every individual. So he got a right from the king to collect whatever taxes he gets out of people, he can squeeze out of people, then that's what he gets to keep. So that the Balei HaTosafot say, that's not called tax collection. That's called gzeila. The Rosh over here says, b'mocheis she'in lo kitzva v'alav dino, t'dafka daver shehu shaveh l'chol b'nei ha'medina. It's only true when it's something that is applied equally to everybody. Yesh lo the reshut, the koneh l'asot. Then the purchaser of the right to tax collection has a right to collect, which seems to be the method that they use there. Either you got permission from the king, and then you were granted the right, and then you gave a portion to the king, or you purchased up front the right to tax collection from the king, and then you collected taxes. That's the way the king did not have to worry about enforcement of the taxes, because he had someone else doing it, and he basically franchised out the tax collection. And by franchising it out, the king didn't have to worry about force, and the person who was forcing, you know, people who didn't like, they didn't like the tax collector. It wasn't necessarily associated with the king. But he bought it from the king, or he bought the right from the king. So this type of franchise is allowed when it's a law of the land that is equally applied to everyone. Aval, the barog, but the varshenu shaveh. Not something that's not equal. The ma'eit, lazeh, ulurabot lazeh. They takes a little from this guy, more from this guy. Inami. Kein shein lo kitzva. So, or the fact that there is no limit, he always ends up taking more than he should, because there is no limit to it. So if you don't have a limit, then by definition you're always taking more than you should, and therefore it's deemed to be gezel. The other option is it's a self-appointed tax collector. So obviously he's a thief, because he's self-appointed. There are those that suggest that he even might be doing it b'shem the king. But the king just didn't appoint anybody in this area. So he decides that he's going to be the volunteer tax collector to take care of what the king wants. But since he doesn't have that real right, he's a thief because he wasn't appointed to represent the king in this case. But what we're saying here is that if it is the law of the land, one does not have the right to abrogate the law of the land because dina de machuta dina, which is the principle that Shmuel says, according to many of the Rishonim, dina machuta dina is actually a din de oraita. It's a din mina Torah. And that's what Shmuel means over here. Dina de machuta dina means mina Torah. One has to abide by the rules of the land. Now, why you have to abide by the rules of the land is subject to machloket, which has major nafkuminot halacha. The Ran over here brings a very famous formulation of the Balei HaTosafot. He says, v'katavu HaTosafot, d'davka b'malchei ovdei kuchavim, amar de dina de machuta dina. This only applies to non-Jewish kings. Mipnei, sha'aretz shelo. Because the land belongs to him. Yechol omar lehem, im lo tasu mitzvotai, egareish etchem en aretz. I own the land. You want to live in the land? You abide by the rules. You don't abide by the rules, he tosses you out. He kicks you out of the land. It's like anybody who has private ownership of land. If you have private ownership of your land, you can make the rules on your land. Somebody doesn't abide by them, you throw them out of your house. They don't have to stay anymore. So this is just on a much more grandiose scale. That the king owns all the land. And since he owns all the land, he has a right to dictate the laws of the land. And if you don't like the laws of the land, then you leave. And that's what Dina Machuta Dina is. But based on that, it only applies to a non-Jewish king. Why? Aval b'malchei Yisrael lo. But by Jewish kings not. Now, Jewish kings doesn't necessarily mean Jewish kings in Chutz La'aretz. It means Jewish kings in Eretz Yisrael. Why? L'fish Eretz Yisrael, kol Yisrael shutafim ba. That we're all partners in Eretz Yisrael. He doesn't own the land in Eretz Yisrael. We own the land. If we own the land, then he can't say to us, either you listen to me or you're out of here, because he can't kick you out of your home. This is your home. And since he can't kick you out, there is no dina machuta dina. Now, it'd be interesting, a non-Jewish king in Eretz Yisrael would be interesting as well. Does he have that dictate? Can, that's a question whether a nochri has a kinyan. in Eretz Yisrael, Pia Kedushata, and whether you can make a Kenyan and really own the land. And the same would be true in Chutz La'aretz. Can the Jew seemingly should be able to make a Kenyan and own the land just like a non-Jewish king? And therefore the din would be the same for a Jewish king or a non-Jewish king in Chutz La'aretz. According to the Ran, number one you have to say is that there's a difference between Eretz Yisrael and Chutz La'aretz. That's first of all. Number two, according to the Ran, there might be an issue, which is what you're saying. This only applies when there's autocratic rule. When there are kings or monarchs that own everything, and then you have to abide by the law of the land because they own everything. In a case where there's private ownership, in a case where you have democratically elected officials, maybe in that case, dina machuta dina doesn't apply according to the Ran because they don't have necessarily that right like the king has to throw you out. Or maybe they do have that right. If they do have that right to throw you out, maybe then they could exert their influence in dina machuta dina, or maybe they can't, and there is no dina machuta dina anymore because there are no kings anymore. So that's what the Ran leaves open. The Ran is, I would say, a very narrow interpretation of what dina de machuta dina is, but his narrow interpretation has significant halachic ramifications in terms of both Eretz Yisrael as well as the modern era. There are other formulations of dina machuta dina which make a lot more sense and probably are more appropriate. There's a Rashbam in Bava Batra. There is, seemingly, the Rambam in Mishneh Torah also makes a similar thing, which is that dina machuta dina is simply a social contract. It's an agreement between the parties that live there that they will abide by the social contract of whatever is deemed to be the rules of the land. And so therefore, if you come into a country, you agree by living in that land, or you agree by sojourning in that land, that you will abide by the laws of the land for the betterment of all the people. And that's the social contract. Whether that's imposed by the king, or whether that is a democratically elected government, the laws are in place in order to ensure order, the safety, and the benefit of all parties that are there. That's what the Mishnah Navot says. If you don't have a king, if you don't have rules, chayim b'lo'o, the place is anarchy. You can't have that. So the social contract is that people who come into these areas agree to abide by the laws of the land. And if they abide by the laws of the land, they can stay. And fine, if not, then the social contract says that you can be knocked out or you can be punished or penalized for not following the rules. And obviously that would have much broader a context. Not only in Chutz La'aretz, that should apply in Eretz Yisrael as well. And number two is that should apply not only to monarchs, that should apply to governments that are elected as well. Because the whole idea is that everybody who lives here agrees to abide by the law. And if you don't agree to abide by the law, there's a sufficient majority here who've come to an agreement about the law, that you then are an outsider and they can penalize you or punish you based on that. So that is a much broader scope of dina machuta dina. It's probably a much more appealing view of dina machuta dina, which is not simply an imposition, but more of a social contract between the individuals there, and obviously has nafkaminot between that and the Ran. Now, even according to that methodology, the Ramban mentions that that's only true if the individual or the king is putting into effect laws that have precedence. That means that it's not something that he invented. It's not a new law that he's coming up with, but something that's well known in the past. People tax the lands. People tax earnings. They do certain things that are considered to be acceptable forms of taxation or acceptable forms of law. Then dina machuta dina applies. But if the guy invents some new law, then that would not apply. That's the way the Ramban formulates it, and other Rishonim pick up on this Ramban's idea that it can't be some crazy law, and then it becomes dina de machuta dina. Dina machuta dina has to have at least some logic behind it, number one. And number two, he says precedent, which is hard, because then you have to have some sort of misora that this is the way that the kings before him conducted themselves. The Ramban is saying that. Might be that the Ramban himself is addressing some of his own plight, which is that he's about to get kicked out, or he was kicked out of the land that he lived in. So you could claim dina machuta dina, and they kicked him out. So he says it has to be something that has precedence. Kicking out a group because of their religious beliefs is not necessarily dina machuta dina. Or it might have precedent. There it might have precedence. But the Ramban is probably affected somewhat by his own predicament. And he says it has to be something that is well established as being dina machuta dina. So that does limit it. The Rambam himself doesn't seem to accept that. He says whatever the king makes up, as long as it's fair and just, then that's fine. He doesn't look for this idea of precedence. Now, the idea of fair and just is brought up right here by the Rosh and mentioned by others as well, this idea of equality, that the law has to be applied equally. If the king applies the law equally across the board, then it's a dina de machuta dina. If the, somehow the king segregates a population or individuals or treats them in a different manner, that is not considered to be dina de machuta dina because that's not din. That's either gzela or that's persecution. That's not dina de machuta dina. Dina de machuta dina has to do with an equal application of the law. Now, what equal application of the law means is subject to machloket. That doesn't mean across his entire malchut he has to do this. Or if he says in certain regions this is the law, in certain regions it's not the law, maybe that's sufficient. As long as there's equal application in a designated area, whether that's a city, whether that's a region, maybe that's enough to be considered dina machut dina, because then there's no bias inside of that particular area. Or does non-bias mean that he has to extend across the entirety of his reign or his sovereignty? So that is, the Mishonim also argue about that issue. So now here you have basically a menu of opinions with regards to dina machut dina. Depending on how you view it, it will make a difference in how much it applies to one, both today or in different situations. The other part of this Gemara that comes up is a Gemara in Baba Kama and Kuf Yud Gimel, but talks about tax collection as well over there and evading taxes. There the Gemara talks about what's called Hafka'at Halvato, that theft is not allowed, but one is allowed to. Hafka'at Halvato means that one is not allowed to basically escape repaying loans, to escape from having to pay debts that they owe, as long, and this is the big caveat, there's no Chilul Hashem involved in it. If there's no Chilul Hashem, that the person won't figure it out. Or if they figure it out, you won't be penalized in a way that creates Chilul Hashem, then that's allowed. But if there's any chashash of Chilul Hashem, then that's not allowed. So clearly today, when someone is caught tax evading, or person's caught because of misappropriating funds and causing problems with the authorities, there's clearly, it's the biggest Chil Hashem you can ever find. They're on the front pages of every newspaper about there, and especially they make sure to write Rabbi, Rabbi on the front page. The Chil Hashem is so great that you can't even justify the risk of going up against the tax authorities or even invoking this principle of Havkat Habato, because the Chil Hashem that's created in the back end is so great that you don't have a right to take such a risk with regards to Chil Hashem. So even if you can halachically determine that maybe it would be allowed in certain instances because of Avkat Halvato, that assumes that there will be no Chil Hashem, and that's just not true. Now, being aggressive in a stance that one takes, that's a reasonable stance that one takes against the tax authorities, that's not considered to be a Chil Hashem. That means that you have a position, it's a logical or it makes sense the position you're taking, and then if they disagree with you in the end, that happens all the time. That's not necessarily a Chil Hashem, that's just a disagreement about interpretation. And that's fine, because that's not creating a Chil Hashem. As long as it's reasonable, as long as something that can be defended, and other parties might take such a similar position. But if it's something where it's simply done to evade taxes, then that's a serious issue. Much of the attitude towards the payment of taxes and towards government comes out of Europe, or places where there was huge persecution, uneven-handedness with regards to taxation and persecution of Jews. And therefore, their attitude towards government derived from that problem. The government was stealing from them. So anything they could do to protect themselves was considered to be valid. And again, valid halakhically, but also valid in terms of protecting their own possessions. But once you move to a place where there is quote-unquote separation of church and state, and where the government applies the laws equally to all parties, and there is no persecution, much of that falls away, especially given the other side, which is the Chil Hashem risk involved in these types of issues. So dina de machuta dina is an important dina. It's important to abide by dina de machuta dina. And based on, leaving out the Ran's opinion here, based on those opinions that it's a social contract, it would equally apply in Israel as it does to other places, equally apply to a democratically elected government as it does to a king, and therefore would have application today in Eretz Yisrael. The exception to that rule that all note is that if it causes you to abrogate a din in the Torah, that if the dina de machuta dina states something that would force you to then breach a Torah law, then Torah is ascendant and the Torah law is first. So if they say if there's a law out there that says you have to be mechal Shabbat, and if you keep your business open on Shabbat, then you don't do it. You don't have to follow dina de machuta dina as an application there. Because dina de machuta dina is subject to, it's a Torah law, therefore it's subject to the primary laws of the Torah, and it can't come to override a law of the Torah. It can have effect in monetary matters, because there you're allowed to make a tnai, conditions against the Torah. Okay, a person is allowed to be matna mashukon to betorah, but dinei memononot. I mean, it's a machloka, but we pass when you can. And therefore, with dinei memononot, it can override. But with dinei yisurim, it cannot override. So dinei machuta dinei cannot override in those situations, those circumstances. For instance, the Torah has certain rules about shomerim, and when they are chayav, and when they're not chayav, in terms of their obligations to another party. If he's a shomer sachar, if he's a shomer chinam, the Torah lays out the laws. If the law of the land is different than that, then that's fine, because that's a tonight, that's a condition that's made against the Torah law, but in monetary matters, and therefore in monetary matters, a tonight can govern, even though it does not follow the dinei Torah, because basically what you're saying is, when I enter into this agreement, we have a built-in condition that we're going to abide by the law of the land, and by abiding by the law of the land, we're not going to necessarily follow what the Torah says, the shomer sachar, shomer chinam will be. So over there, that's not an abrogation necessarily of Torah law, because you're making a tonight in dinei mamonot. In cases where it has to do with dinei yisur, where the government says you have to eat non-kosher, you're not allowed to give a bris milah, you're not allowed to keep Shabbat, those are laws that will not take effect, meaning that dinei machut dinei has no application anymore, because you can't make a din that forces you to do something against the Torah, dinei yisurim. It's interesting, the way that the Rishonim formulated here, there's three different formulations. One formulation here is a moche shein lo kitzva. Another one is a mechesa oyveid me'elav. There's a third formulation, the Rambam, when he codifies this in Hilchot Gzeilah Vaveido, he says, moches akum. It's a non-Jewish tax collector. So then, the Mefarshim have to deal with, why is a non-Jewish tax collector okay to lie to him or try to evade taxes with him? That takes two routes. One route is the route of Baba Kama, which is Hafkat Halvato. If you steal in a way that's not actively stealing, but just not paying back your loans or what you owe or your obligations, and that's fine when it comes to an akum. So that method might deal with the melches akum, and that might be the reason why the Rambam codifies it that way. But then that's subject to the rule of chilul Hashem, which is if that he can figure it out, or he knows you're doing that, then it's a chilul Hashem, and you cannot do that whatsoever. The second approach to melches akum is that the understanding was that the stam melches akum was a ganav or a gazlan, that the Mokhez HaKom was not acting properly or even-handedly, and the Mokhez HaKom was taking advantage, whether it's the Jewish population or people in general, he was a gazlan. And since he's a gazlan, therefore you don't have to pay him. But what comes from all those categories tells you that if a person is collecting in a proper manner, and he's doing it on behalf of the duly elected government, then he doesn't have to pay taxes. So if a business is collecting sales tax on behalf of the government, but they're collecting, like here in Israel, they're collecting the VAT or the MOM tax. It's a fixed percentage. Everybody pays it. And they're empowered by the government to do it. So in that case, they're actually collecting on behalf of the government in a fair and just manner. There's no reason that you can avoid that tax or evade that tax. Pay a person cash, the obligation on declaration is on the collector. It's not your obligation. If he so chooses, you can pay him whatever you want. He has to make a decision about how he pays. His obligation is to pay. And his obligation is to declare the money. How, if he does or doesn't do that, you don't have to enforce it on him. And maybe you can't be a party necessarily where it's obvious or he's asking you for that to avoid the mom, then maybe it's more problematic. But in general cases with sales tax, it's the obligation of the collection party to do it. And how you pay is up to you, and how he decides what to do with it is up to him. Turn the Ryan, in a sense, empowered not to pay taxes in Israel based on that. Now, whether the Rambam will also agree to, like, the Rashbam and the Rambam's formulation that there's also a social contract can override as well, then you would need to give taxes not because of Dina Machuta Dina, but because of this social contract. That might maybe agree to that. But the Rambam, he formulates it over here, the way the Rambam formulates it here, Al-Yadei Balei Tosafot, technically you would not have to pay taxes today in Israel. Maybe for two reasons. One is not a king. We're talking about a democratically elected government. Number two is because it's in Eretz Yisrael. And a Jew in Eretz Yisrael doesn't necessarily has his own rights. And that's a very problematic stance to take. Again, because of the Mishnah Avot, which is, do you want anarchy? Is that the choice that you really want to make? Right? So if you don't want anarchy, then maybe you really did agree to it. Because you know that if somebody comes and there's a thief and steals from you, you're going to call the police and have them come in. Why? Because you want a certain say there. You want a certain amount of rights and protection from the government. Well, if you're willing to do that, that means that you are really agreeing to live here or abide by the contract that the government gives. So if you want that part of the government's authority, then you're going to want the whole thing. And therefore, maybe you do, or you're opting into the agreement in that way. And that's probably the most binding part of this. Again, some of the Rishonim stated clearly that's what Dina Machuta Dina is. But maybe even if you don't state it that way, maybe if you are exercising certain rights or privileges under the contract, then maybe you're automatically part of the contract, because how can you demand certain privileges and rights and then not the responsibilities or not agree to others? It seems to me that that would be an unfair taking advantage of a social contract. Either you're in or you're out. If you want the privileges, you've got to be in, and that means you're in for everything. You don't want the privileges, then opt out for everything. But opting out for everything means everything. It means that you're not taking medical care. That means you're not taking protection of the police. If you're going to opt out, you have to opt out in a manner that is completely opting out. I will say there is one exception to the rule. Rav Avadia Yosef writes about this, which is an issue that the Gemara states that one is not allowed to collect taxes from Talmidei Chachamim. The Talmidei Chachamim are exempt from taxes and tax collection. So that might be an issue, because then even if the Dina Machuta Dina comes, that might be Neged Dina de Gemara. So if we said before that you're not allowed to have Dina Machuta that overrides the Dina the Torah or Dina de Gemara, now you have a serious issue, because then Talmidei Chachamim are technically exempt from taxes or tax collection based on the Dina de Gemara. And what the government's doing then is quote unquote illegal under Jewish law, and therefore you wouldn't have to abide by that. Now that still has to come with another part to it, which is then, first of all, you'd have to define properly what a Talmid Chacham is. That's one. Number two, you'd have to then say, well, if the person's opting out because they're a Talmid Chacham out of the taxes, does that mean that they also opt out of other certain things that Talmid Chachamim wouldn't accept? Okay, it's not a simple thing. The proper way to act and behave is to pay one's taxes, and therefore, he doesn't become, number one, a Chilul Hashem, which is the most important factor here. There's nothing that can override Chilul Hashem. That's very important. And it's also important that if one is taking monies from the government, which almost anybody who lives in this country does, because there's subsidization of education, there's subsidization of medical care, and all these things come from the government money. So that's what I'm saying. People are beneficiaries of those government payments. Then it behooves the person to also pay in, just because, forgetting about any halacha, any about dinu machuta dina, which is that simply if you're a beneficiary, you want to pay for that benefit. It's only fair for you to pay for the benefits that you receive. All right, that's just a little summary. It's a big topic and a very hot topic for sure. Throughout the ages, it's addressed mostly because of the unfairness and persecution. Today, it's addressed from the opposite side, which is now that there is a fair system. How does Dina Machuta Dina apply now? Or what are the rules here? How much of these rules do apply or don't apply anymore now when we have a very different system in place? Now the Gemara moves on and says, Heichad Nadar. What nether are we talking about here? The Ran, or the basic question of the Ran is, how do you have a nether like this? A shvua can be taken to substantiate information. You can say, shvua that this is so-and-so, or shvua that this is such-and-such. You can take such a shvua. A neder only has application to a chefza, only has application to an object itself. So for you to say, I take a neder that this is truma, is meaningless. Because you can't take a neder in that form. A neder can only be about something else. Very good. So the Gemara answer is similar to what it said before, which is that the neder taken here is about another object, like the Mishnah states over here, konam, where they say, konam anina anit l'ishti, if this is not truma. So meaning that the nether is connected to another object. The Isra Hana'ah is connected to a specific object. And that's what's being used to substantiate your statement with regards to the Truma. And that's what he says. Amar Rav. Bomer Yasru Perot Olam Alai. Im Einan Shel Beit HaMelech. All the fruits of the world will be Asur to me, and seemingly permanently, if this does not belong to the king. Kevan. Now the Gemara says, wait a minute. Kevan Damar Yasru. It's Aralei Koperi Alma. Wait a minute. If the case is that when he takes such a nether, they should be Asur. He's lying. And he triggered the nether. He says, these will be Asur for me forever if this is not the king's. Guess what? It's not the king's. So he should have triggered the nether. The nether should be enforced right now. Ba'omer Hayom. He says, only for today. I damar Hayom, lo mikabu me moches. Wait a minute. That's not going to work so well. Yeah, listen, I won't eat any fruits today if this does belong to the king. The guy goes, what type of joke is this? Yeah, so a guy doesn't eat fruits for a day? That's not, he could be lying through his teeth. That's not a way to do it. It's not going to work anymore. Bomer bilibo hayom. It's a case where in his heart he says hayom, omotzi bisfatav stam. But when he articulates it, he leaves out the word hayom. Even though we've already established a principle that Dvarim shebelev enam dvarim. It doesn't matter what you're thinking when you articulate something. The gabei on a sin shiny. With regards to duress, it does make a difference. Now, there are two stages to this Gemara, and they both have to be addressed. The first stage of the Gemara is that if you took such a nether, it would go into force. It would take effect. How come this is not like Nidrei Shkagot? Nidarim, or Nidrei Avai, all the Nidarim that we talk about in this Perek, where a person clearly does not intend for the nether to take effect, and therefore it doesn't take effect. How come over here it's taking effect according to the Gemara? The Gemara says, well, if it's true, then Enochanami is going to be Isur. The second thing is, then why do Dvarim Shvaleiv work over here? So the Balei HaTosafot would have a formulation, the Rosh has a similar formulation, which is very important over here, which is that, what's the difference between this and the other Nidarim in our Perek? He says, V'kevan de'anan sahadei, harei yikilu perish behedja, v'lo havin Dvarim Shvaleiv. That in the cases before in our Perek, like the case where he said that all the Tainim are Serim, and then he finds out it's his father or his brother. So over there, how come over there the nether fell away automatically? The answer is because Anansade. We know for sure that he did not intend to include his father and his brother. So since it's something that from an external side, from someone an outsider would be able to see and make that determination quickly, that that's not true, that's why the nether falls away without a petach. Over here, he's telling the truth. He's at least claiming that he's telling the truth. And therefore, it's not always clear that with this, from an outsider's perspective, that this nether should fall away. Why? When he takes the nether, he really means to take the nether. Because he wants to convince the guy there that it really is true. Mar really is belonging to the Beit HaMelech. So he takes the nether in that form in order to substantiate his statement. That means that he really wants the nether to be believed, and he really wants the nether to be there. So he can't just unwind it and say Anansade in this case. Had it not been for the duress, you would not say Anansade. So in another situation where a guy who takes a nether without duress, and he says, I want Yisru Perot Olam Alai, if this doesn't belong to Beit HaMelech. He's not under duress. Well, if that's the case and it doesn't belong to the king, he's going to be Asur in the Perot. Meaning that the nether inherently does not have an Anansade in it. It's only because of the context of the nether that there is an Anansade. Ben Talmud Chacham Ben Amaretz Mitzar Belonis. If it wasn't for the fact that there was duress here, then I would say that it's Asur. So what the Balei HaTosafot are saying is that there's a difference between these Nidarim over here and the Nidarim in the rest of the Perek. The rest of the Perek Nidarim fall away because no matter what the circumstances is, if you have the information that you have now, it's clear that the Nether was taken and didn't mean to be taken. It wasn't meant to be taken in that way. On the other hand, when you're talking about Nidrei Ones, the really context is so important over here. Without duress, these are full-fledged Nidarim. It's only because of the duress there's a problem. So because of that, we require over here this extra level, which is Dvarim Shebelev. We require Hayom, to you say it in Alev. Now, the Dvarim Shebelev now become real because Shiny Ocham. Because it's different over here because of the duress. That means without the duress, they would not work. Dvarim Shebelev, if you said Hayom in your mind, and then Hotzi B'Piv, that wouldn't matter. Because whatever you articulated is really what you meant. What you had in your heart doesn't matter anymore. But, in a case here where you have the duress that's associated with it, now we have a different thing. So the Ron has a similar formulation that there's a big difference between Lola Main Dvarim Shalev and Batlim Mashotzi M'Piv, Afila Gabi Unso Kiai, El Dehocha Stomach Amar. You have to be careful. It depends what he says. If he says, Perot Ha'olam Yasrim Alai Le'olam, he says, Perot Ha'olam are also to me forever, then it doesn't matter if he says Ayom in his heart. Because there he articulated something that contradicts what he has believed. It's only when he takes the nether Stam, which he says, Perot Ha'olam Alai, and is not qualified by Ayom or the Olam, then he can use the Ayom to qualify it because of the duress that will help him. So the duress helps him in that situation. But if you make a statement that contradicts the other statement, does not work at all. So you have to be careful to, first of all, make the nether in a way or a manner that does not contradict what you're trying to say in your heart, that it's interpretable, that the nether that you've taken has multiple interpretations. It can mean forever, it can mean for today. Then in your heart, you limit it to today, and that does it. So the Ron says over here that you have to do it in a way that is ambiguous, and then using the Libo interpretation with duress together, that allows you to escape the nether. But if you articulate something that makes it impossible to change it in your heart, doesn't work. And number two is if you don't have anything in your heart, it doesn't work because of what Tosafot said. It's not Anansade over here. It's not obvious that the nether is not to take effect It's only because of the external duress that it's happening. The nether inherently, there's nothing wrong with the nether. The nether is a fine nether, just happens to be because of the context that makes it a bad nether. Without that context, it wouldn't have been a bad nether. All right, so now the Gemara says, the Gemara here is quoting our Mishnah. It's a whole Mishnah. Beishamim b'chol, beishamim amim b'meh shum adiro, beitil amim af b'she'in mediro, Ketzer amar lo konam ishto nenet li, v'amar konam ishti u'banai nenet li, beishamim amim ishto mutarit v'nav asurim, beitil amim elu b'elu mutarim. So we just quoted the whole Mishnah over here. Then the Gemara quotes the Braita. Amravuna tano, beishamim amim lo yiftach lo b'shvua. He should not open with a shvua. He should open up with a shvua. Now this braita presents an issue with our Mishnah from two perspectives, and that's what the Gemara is going to question. The Beit Shammai, based on the braita, bishvuahu delo yiftachlo, ha beneder yiftachlo. Based on the braita, you would infer that he can't open with a shvua, but he could open with a neder. Our Mishnah of Atznan, our Mishnah says Beit Shammai lo yiftachlo beneder, that he can't open with the neder. So that's number one problem. Number two is vitu. Miftachu delo yiftachlo bishvua. The braita also seems to indicate he can't open with a shvua. But that means if he demanded a shvua, you could respond with a shvua. Ha midar neder bishvua. But he could take such a shvua if it was demanded of him. Vatznan. Beit Shammai omrim, behold no dream chutz mi bishvua. That you're not allowed to use a shvua whatsoever. So in these two ways, the diuk out of that braita is contradictory to our Mishnah. So how do you reconcile that braita with our Mishnah? Tana matznitin bin neder. Our Mishnah focused on neder lahodi achat kochan de Beit Shammai, to show you the power of Beit Shammai. The Beit Shammai says even by a neder lo yiftach lo, that even by a neder you shouldn't open with the neder. You have to wait for them to do it. Don't do it of your own volition. So that's why our Mishnah mentioned neder. Tana de braita, the Tana of the braita bishvua. They focus on Shvua, though, diachav kuchan de Beit Hillel, to show you the power of Beit Hillel, which is koach de hetera. Now, koach de hetera is odif, so therefore we would focus on Beit Hillel's position, that even by a Shvua, Beit Hillel says you can open with a Shvua, not only if they ask you for it, but you can open with a Shvua. If koach de hetera is odif, why does our Mishnah not go with that side of the picture? Because they knew about the Braita. The Mishnah relying on the Braita, that's what the Rosh says, therefore it showed us the power of Beit Shammai. The Braita shows us the power of Beit Hillel, that even with a Shvua, you're allowed to volunteer a Shvua. And the Mishnah tells us the power of Beit Shammai, that even with a Neder, you're not allowed to open with the Neder. You can only do it if you were asked to give a Neder. And that's the difference between the Mishnah and the Braita. Ravashi Amar Hochiktani. This is what's meant by the Braita, and this is something we saw in Machloket Rishonim before. Bicharamim Omrim, Ein Sheila Bishvua. There is no Hatarat Nidarim or Hatarat Shvua. Beit Hillel Omrim, Yesh Sheila Bishvua. There is Hatara with regards to Shvua. This goes back to a machloka we saw between Rashi and Tosafot earlier about Lo Yiftach Lo. You could read Lo Yiftach in two different ways. Petach is the terminology that the Mishnah and the Gemara uses for Hatarat Nidarim. Petach or Yiftach can also mean to open with. So how do you interpret Lo Yiftach Lo in our Mishnah? Is Lo Yiftach Lo, you shouldn't voluntarily say it, mean now don't open with this? Or does lo yiftachlo mean, do not use a heter in this manner? There is no hatara in this manner. We saw that machlok between Rashi and Tosafot regards to charata. When it says lo yiftachlo b'charata, does that mean don't open with charata? But if it comes up later, if he volunteers it, it's okay. But the chacham can't open with that. Or does lo yiftachlo b'chatara mean, don't do hatara nedarim with charata? So same thing over here. What Ravashi is saying is you're misinterpreting the lo yiftachlo and the braita. In the braita, you're misinterpreting lo yiftachlo. Lo yiftachlo does not mean don't volunteer this, don't open with this, but rather don't do hatara with this. That's what it means, lo yiftachlo. The lo yiftachlo of the Mishnah means don't volunteer, don't do it of your own volition. The lo yiftachlo of the braita means don't do hatara. And so they're talking about different dinim. And what they're arguing about over there is there hatarat nidarim for a shvua? Beit Shammai says no hatara for a shvua. Beit Hillel says yes, there is hatara for shvua, but that does not contradict our Mishnah because it's a different meaning of lo yiftach lo. Okay, the next Mishnah now begins, and this Mishnah is difficult to understand both internally, the Mishnah itself, as well as what its relevance is to the Perek and maybe even to the Masechta in general, which is Harei Nitiota Elu Kurban Im Einan Niktzatzot. These saplings are a Kurban. Now, what that means, we'll have to understand in a second. Im eina niktzatzot, if they are not cut down. Talit zo korban. This talit will be a korban. Im eina nisrefet, if it is not burnt up. Yesh lahem pijon, then they do have redemption. Hare nitiot ha'elu korban ad shiyakatzatzu. If he phrases it this way, that these saplings will be a korban until they are cut down. Talit zo korban ad shetisarev. That this talit is a korban until it is burnt. Ein lahem pidyon. Then they do not have a redemption. Now, first of all, the question you have to ask is, when he says the word korban over here, what is the meaning of the word korban? You could see in the Rishonim, the Rosh, the Tosafot, the Ran, they all bring that the word korban over here does not mean what we've said until now in the Masechta, Iser Hana'a, or an Iser Hatpasa. Because generally that would require an additional language of either korban alai or korban alav, that it would affect him or someone else. You have to be matpis towards that individual, the isur that you're trying to create. When you say the word korban by itself, it literally means lit korban. Now obviously we're not talking about a real korban, because we're talking about saplings and a talit over here, but rather it's made korban. And so therefore, the majority of the Rishonim over here explained that our Mishnah is talking about a person who is maktish these items for Zemehem, their monetary worth to be given, to be utilized as a korban. And that's what's meant by the word korban over here. Then, the other parts of the Mishnah are more understandable, which is, yesh lahem pidyon, they do have redemption, one can redeem them and take the kedusha off of them. That's the first part of the Mishnah. Ein lahem pidyon, and the second half of the Mishnah is not in the sense that you cannot redeem them at all, but rather if you redeem them, it is not helpful. Because even if you redeem them, the kedusha stays on the item, and you would have to redeem them again. And that has to do with the difference in the way that he worded it. In the first case, he worded it in such a way that after he redeems it, the kedusha will not return. Whereas in the second case, he seems to be imposing a permanent kedusha on these items, until the action that he describes here transpires. Whether that means cutting down the saplings or the burning of the talit, then every time you redeem it, their kedusha returns to that item. That's the basic way that most of the Rishonim here explain the Mishnah. The greatest difficulty with that is, what is it doing here? Why is it in this perek, first of all? Tell me about what's it doing in this Masechta. This Masechta is about Nidrei Isurin, not about Nidrei Hekdesh. And on top of that, even if it is speaking about Nidrei Hekdesh, that might be relevant to our Masechta, what does it have to do with this perek that we just discussed, the four Nidarim that automatically unwind themselves? What does that have to do with this perek? So the Rosh over here explains that, Davi Kimo Nidrei Shkogot, that this Mishnah, the Nidarim that are taken in our Mishnah are similar to Nidrei Shkogot, the Daita Ochi Akdashinu, because he was Matish them for a particular purpose. Shaya Savur Shiev Shaliot Nitzolim, he thought they would never be saved, Velo Gamar B'li Bolak Disham. Therefore, he really didn't have Gemirat Hadat or Gemirat Aleiv to be Makdish them. That has to do with an Ukimta that the Gemara is going to make, that the context in which this situation is, why is he talking about cutting down saplings and burning a talit? Must be that there's some sort of event that is transpiring that caused him to worry about the fact that these saplings will not be able to be cut down, or this talit will not be able to be utilized anymore. And therefore, he says he's makdish them because basically he has yeush. He doesn't think he's going to see them again. So what the Rosh says is that really basically makes it into a Nidrei Shkaga. Because he really didn't intend to be makdish it if he could salvage these items. He only was makdish them because he thought he couldn't salvage them. Kamash Malon. Despite that fact, we say, Dvarim Shalev, Kihani, Dolo Mukhe Lo Avian Dvarim. Dvarim Shalev, obviously, the context and what he's thinking matter, but here they're not Mukhach. That goes back to what we said in the Tosfot before, Anan Sade. If it's obvious what's going on, based on the wording of his Neder or the nature of his Neder, then that's called Dvarim Shalev we worry about. But over here, where there's no Anan Sadeh, the wording of his nether is very clear. What he's saying here is clear. Okay, the context might affect. That might be similar to the Nidrei Anasim that we saw before. That the person takes the nether, which seemingly is a full-fledged nether, because of the context of the duress. That's why we said before that Dvarim Shvalev have meaning. But over here, where there's no duress, and yes, there is an outside stimuli that's causing him to take the nether,
Nevertheless, that's not enough to make the Dvarim Shebelev matter. And therefore, over here, they're not considered to be Nidresh Kagot. So that's what the Rosh says is the connection to this Perek and why this Mishnah is here. Tosafot on the Amud Bet asks a similar question and says something very similar. He says, Vim Tomar, Manyin Zeh Lashar Nidarim Dilael, Duktani Dalin Nidarim Etiru. You would thought these are like Nidre Ziruzim. That the neder is only here to substantiate what he's saying. That the chance that these things aren't going to be saved. He basically has Yehush, they're going to be lost. So it's a Nidre Ziruzim to say, well, if I can cut them down, then they won't be Ekdesh. Basically, to substantiate his statement that these things are going to be lost. Not because he really intends to be makdish them, if they are saved, kamash malon, and that's what the Mishnah is telling us. Afilu achi hava kedushot, they are kadosh. The gamar b'libo lakdisham, he did have a gemira tadat to be makdish them. She savur hu she yachol liot de mitzlan, because in his mind, in the back of his mind, he thinks maybe they will be saved. The only reason to makdish them is because there's that remote possibility that they would be saved. So because of that, both the Rosh and the Tosafot explain what this Mishnah is doing over here. The Ran brings an alternative view that actually the word Korban here is used like it means in the rest of the Masechta, which means that it's a Konam, that it is actually a Nidre Isurim, but it is based or premised on the Shita of Rabbi Meir. Shita of Rabbi Meir, who says that Konam, when you use that terminology of Konam or Korban with regards to Nidre Isur, then they take on the properties like Hekdesh, and there's an Isser Mi'ilah if you violate that Neder. And there is Pijon, you have the ability to redeem such an object from that Isur. But that's unique to the Konam. And that's what's happening in our Mishnah. Our Mishnah here is talking about a case where he utilized a Konam, and the Stam Mishnah is like Rabbi Meir, that you can function with that Konam like you do in Hekdesh. And that's what the Mishnah is saying here. It's talking about a regular Isser Anah. And then Isranah is subject to the same rules of Ekdesh because he utilized Konam. And Konam, according to Rabbi Meir, works within Nidre Yisurim, can Nidre Ekdesh. Now, that helps explain what it's doing in our Masechta. Again, with regards to what it's doing in our Perek, you would still have to invoke something along the lines of what the Rosh or the Tosafot said as to why it's included here in the Perek. Now, the Gemara asks, Velitne Kedoshot Vein Kedoshot. Why doesn't the Mishnah, instead of saying Yesh lehem pidyon, that they have a redemption, Ve'ein lehem pidyon, they don't have a redemption, why doesn't it simply say Kedoshot, they are Kadosh, Ve'ein Kedoshot, and they're not Kadosh? So now all the Rishonim here say that this Girsa is problematic. The Lord of the Ran, the Tosafot, the Rosh, they all say that the only thing that should be in the Girsa here is Velitne Kedoshot. Let us say that they are Kadosh. There is no option in the Mishnah of something that is not Kadosh. There are only two options in the Mishnah. There's the Reisha, where it's Kadosh, and you can redeem it. And then there's the Sefer, where it's Kadosh, and you can't redeem it. But both of them are Kadosh. So that option of Ein Kedoshot is not really an option in terms of describing what's going on in the Mishnah. And therefore, the Rishonim all here say that the Girsa should be Velitnei Kedoshot. But two exceptions. Rashi over here says no. That what it means over here, Kedoshot, Ve'ein Kedoshot, is a terminology that we use other places in Shas, when we mean to mean something is partially this way and partially that way. Which is, for instance, by a get. How is a get? Vaino get. It is a get, but it's not a get. That doesn't mean two separate things. It means that it is quasi a get, and it's quasi not a get. It's in that in-between status, that gray area of maybe being a get, maybe not being a get. And similar over here, the concept of kedoshot, vein kedoshot, means they're kedoshot because they have kedusha with them, but they're not kedoshot to the extent that you can redeem them, so they don't have that permanent state of kedoshot. And that's what the Gemara is asking over here, litnei kedoshot, vein kedoshot. So that's where Rashi addresses the issue and says, we'll use that as a description of the first case in the Mishnah. Instead of saying yesh lehem pidyon, you should use the language of kedoshot, vein on kedoshot, that they have this partial kedusha, kedusha enough to be kadosh, but not enough to prevent you from taking pijon. As opposed to the latter half of the Mishnah, where they are kedoshot, the gamrei, where they're kadosh, and you cannot redeem them. The Tosafot brings from the Ri also an alternative to keep the girsa intact. Perish the Shapir Garsin and Lei, the Darvayu Kaime Aresha. They're both going on the Resha, and it means this, Litnei Hochi. Elu kadoshot, imeno niktatzot. If they're not cut down, the saplings, then they're kadosh. Veinam kadoshot, im niktatzu. And if they were cut down, they are not kadosh, meaning that the t'nai or the condition that he built into his nether. If the t'nai is coming true, then they're kadosh. If the t'nai is not coming true, meaning that they were cut down, then they are not kadosh. And that's what he means, litnei kadoshot, vein kadoshot. But in general, the Gemara's question here is, why are you losing a lashon of pidyon? Why are you skipping over the first stage? The first stage in determining the status of any item is it kadosh or is it not kadosh? The second question will be then, does it have pidyon or does it not have pidyon? You skip the first step. Why is that? Gemara says, I did divide the mitna seifa in lem pidyon, tananami resho yesh lem pidyon. That because in the seifa you had to write pidyon, in the resho it also had to write pidyon. The reason being that in the seifa it's not enough to tell us that they are kadosh. They are kadosh, that's true. But the more important factor in the seifa is that ein lahem pidyon. That once they are kadosh, you can't redeem them. Now, if you know you can't redeem them, then obviously they are kadosh. So in the seifa, you have to use a lashon of ein lahem pidyon. So for parallel structure in the Mishnah, out of a literary style, the Mishnah used, in the first half of the Mishnah, yesh lahem pidyon. Ein ochanami, kadoshot, according to most of the Rishonim here, would have been sufficient. According to Rashi, writing kadoshot, ein on kadoshot, would have worked. The reason that we don't do that is because the seifa of the Mishnah uses the terminology of the ein lahem pidyon, which is absolutely necessary, and therefore, to keep a consistent style in the Mishnah, the Tan of the Mishnah wrote in the beginning, yesh lahem pidyon. But yes, he probably should have used the loan of kadoshot, but again, to keep parallel structure, he did not. Now the Gemara asks, heche nadar. What exactly is this neder that he is taking over here? As the Ron explains over here, that how is this working? If he says that these things are asurim v'ana, or these things are hekdesh, imei niktatzot, if they're not cut down. But the end game for any tvuah that is standing is that it will be cut down. So if that's the case, what type of nether is he taking over here? This nether will never take effect, because in the end, this wheat will be cut down. If it will be cut down, then the nether will never go into effect. So what type of nether is this? Or what type of hektish is it? And that's the question, or the nature of the question here in the Gemara, which is what exactly, or what type of nether is he actually taking in this instance? And then the Gemara answer is, Amar Meimar, there's a context. The nether is being taken in a context where there is a good likelihood that they will not be cut down, which is, Amar Meimar Bomer, Im Einan Niktatzot Hayom, that if they're not cut down today, and if the day passes and they're not cut down, then they will be kadosh or they will be asur bana. So he sets a time frame in which this must take place. So now it's no longer this unlimited span of time in which he could cut them down, which would negate the nether. There's a specific time span or limit to the time in which this is true. But it says, imkain lamali de meimar, pshita. What do you mean? Then what do you need the Mishnah to tell me that? If he says it's going to expire today, then if they're cut down, sure enough, then they won't be a nether. If they're not cut down, there is a nether. You don't need a Mishnah to tell you that. That's obvious. That's a straightforward din in nidarim. I says, lo, tzricha. Now we need it. Kegon. Here is the context in which it happened. De'ika zika de nefisha. There was this great wind coming, these great blasts. The storm is coming. So now, in that context, there's a fear that the storm or the winds that are coming are going to knock out the tvuah. He will not have a chance to harvest the tvuah because they will be destroyed or severed by the wind or the storm that is coming. And that's what he means, that these will be kadosh im ein niktatzot, if I don't get a chance to cut them down. Meaning that he assumes that if the wind comes and destroys them, that that's what makes them into kadosh. But if he's kotsates them, if he does have the ability to cut them down, then they would not be kadosh. So now there's another factor involved in terms of the kedusha here. Why did he not cut them down today? Because if he's not successful cutting down today, he thinks basically they're going to be destroyed by the storm. So what happens if they survive the storm and he doesn't cut them down today? They are kadosh. Again, that should be pshita. It's not so pshita because when he took the ned there, he assumed that they were going to be destroyed. The only reason he was makdish them, like the Balei HaTosafot say, was l'amena devarav, to show that he thinks basically there's yeush here. He's going to give up hope. There's no chance these things are going to survive the storm. And since there's no chance they're going to survive the storm, that's why he's makdish them. Then when they survive the storm, you would have thought maybe the neder does not take effect. The Mishnah tells you that's not the case. He made a neder, and therefore, according to the Rosh, Dvarim Shebalei, Benam Dvarim, or according to the Balei Tosafot, he should have had this potential outcome in mind, and therefore the neder does take effect. And that means that if they survive this day, not being knocked out by the storm, and not being harvested by him, they would be kadosh. So Gemara says, Vaktani lo gabi talit. That explains well the situation with regards to the grain. But with the talit, how are you going to explain that? But talit, the sreifa kaimo? A talit is going to end up being burnt? That's the end game for a talit? Why would you think that in this scenario? Why is he taking a neder in such a manner? Yes, that is the case. Going to Ika Daleka. There's a fire spreading through the town. And this individual has his talit there. And he basically thinks he's going to lose his talit. He's going to lose his cloak to the fire that's there. So Achanami, and so too in our case, the Ika Zika Nefisha. So too in our case, it must be a scenario in which we're talking about this strong wind. So by a talit, you cannot argue that the end game of a talit is that it's going to get burnt up. So you must have to explain the context in which he's taking this neder is a context in which there's a fire present. Well, if that's the case by the talit, by the cloak, then that's also the case by the grain or the tevuah. Must be the neder that he's taking is in a context where there's some sort of danger that's going to take out the tevuah. So like by the talit where there's a fire that could possibly take it out, so to over here there's a danger to the grain that's standing there is the strong wind or the storm that is coming. So in both cases he takes a neder that there'll be kadosh if, according to, in the case of the grain, if I don't successfully cut it down today, meaning that he thinks the storm's going to take it out, if they do survive the storm, now it is hekdesh. The same with the talit. He says, it's kadosh if it doesn't survive the fire. Well, his assumption is that it's going to get burnt up in the fire. But if it does survive the fire, then it is kadosh. Even though, in a sense, that wasn't his intent. The reason he took the neder is because he thought it wouldn't survive. But now when it does survive, it is kadosh. And here is the Hava Mina that makes this Mishnah relevant to our Perek and our Masechta. The Mesek Adate, the Lo Mitnatzlan. He thought originally that they would not survive or be saved. And that's why he took the neder. So you would think this is equivalent to a nidrei shkagot. Kamash malon, that is not the case. That here it's different than nidrei shkagot, either because there is no anansade over here, or because he should have anticipated that possibility that it might survive, and therefore it's included or incorporated in his neder because it's not an unreasonable outcome in this situation. And because of those reasons, the neder is chal. It doesn't have the same trappings as the nedarim that we had earlier in the perek. Now, the truth is, if we read the Mishnah the other way, the alternative that the Ran brought, that the author of Mishnah is Rabbi Meir, and we're talking about konamot here, that of a din like hekdesh, then what's the Gemara's question of litnei kedoshot? Vein kedoshot? That's not really a question, because the big chiddush of the Mishnah is the fact that Rabbi Meir thinks that you can redeem it. That is the big chiddush, and that's important for the Mishnah to state. The reason that it wrote Pidyon is to tell us that this Mishnah is like Rabbi Meir and not like the Chachamim. The Ran says, nevertheless, it still is a question, the language here, because by saying Yeshlem Pidyon, then you're automatically saying that it's Pashut, that there's Kedusha here. And that is not so simple, as we've discussed now, and as the Gemara discusses over here, it's not so simple. And therefore, that's the questioning of the Gemara along the way here, is what is this so simple? Why is there such simplicity in assumption that there will be Kedusha? Why is there such an assumption of simplicity that there definitely is Kedusha here? It is not so obvious, both because of the conclusion here of the Gemara that maybe you would have thought it's not a neder, as well as the fact that just because Rabbi Meir is the author of the Mishnah doesn't mean that it's Kadosh. It might be he's the author of the Mishnah, but if it's not Kadosh, then there's no Pidyon. So why do you automatically assume there is Kedusha? And that's how the Ran continues to explain the Gemara, leave it to those that say that our Mishnah is talking about a case of Konam, of a Neder Isur, rather than Demei Korban, the monies that were being dedicated towards a Korban. Now the Gemara brings a Machlokin with regards to the second half of our Mishnah. The first half of our Mishnah says that that's regular type of Hekdesh or Isur, and therefore if you're Poder them, then the Kedusha is gone, those monies will take over the Kedusha, and then they will be spent towards a Korban. Or, with regards to Konamot, then the Isur will shift from the object to the monies themselves. But in the second half of our Mishnah, the phraseology that he used causes the Kedusha to return, which is, Arei Nitiot Elu Korban Ad Shikatsutsu. they will remain kadosh until they're cut down. Which means that even if you redeem them, the kedusha comes back automatically on them because you said they will remain kadosh until you cut them. So even if you redeem them, yes, the kesef will take on the properties of kedusha, but then the object, after you've redeemed it, will turn to be kadosh. Because that's what your statement said. Your statement said it'll always return to be kadosh. How long does that last? This is a makloket. The olam, is that forever that it keeps coming back? Amar barpado p'dan chozrot v'kodshot. That if a person redeems them, then they come back and become kadosh. Padan chozrot v'kodshot ajikad tzitzu. Then that takes place. Until they're cut down, it will continue to happen. Every time you redeem it, the kedusha will return to them. On the other hand, nik tzitzu, once they're cut down, podan pamachat, then you redeem them once, vidayo, and that's sufficient. So the kedusha is there until the cutting, and the kedusha is so there until the cutting that even if you redeem it, the kedusha will continue to return, because that's what you said in your statement. On the other hand, once you've cut it down, then you have one redemption, and the kedusha is removed from the object. On the other hand, v'ula amar, kevin shen nik tzitzu, shuv ein podan. Once you cut them down, your nether said they're kadosh until you cut them. You cut them, ain podam. You don't have to redeem them because the kedusha is gone. Tomorrow's Gemara asks, and that's the question in tomorrow's Gemara, kedusha sheben heichan achal. Where did the kedusha disappear to? So we'll deal with that in tomorrow's Gemara. But here you have a machlokah between Ula and Barpada. And there's a machlokah to Rishonim as to how to explain this. The way that we explain it, and the simple way to explain it, the Ryan brings this down, and most of the Rishonim explain it this way, is that Ula agrees fundamentally to what Barpada says, which is Barpada says that it remains kadosh until you cut it. Then, after you cut it, that's where the machloket is. Barpada says that you still need an additional redemption after the cutting or the harvesting of this grain. On the other hand, Ula says once you harvest it, the kedusha is gone, it disappears. So that would be the machloket between them. The Ran over here quotes in the name of the Rashba, and it's pretty well accepted by most of the Rishonim. On the other hand, the Ran quotes from HaChacham HaGadol, Rav Moshe Kortavi, Zal, that he gives a different explanation. He says that Barpada and Ula argue across the board, which is that Ula says that if you redeem it, then it does not have Kedusha come back to it. That means, even if you redeem it while it's still attached to the ground, or if you cut it down, then it no longer requires a redemption at all. On the other hand, Barpada disagrees on both of those points. He disagrees that after it's cut down that you don't need to redeem it. He says you need to redeem it. But he also disagrees that if you redeem it when it's still attached to the ground, that doesn't make it chulin. It still returns to its original kedusha. So they're actually arguing on both points. Now, why doesn't Ula say that? Ula should mention the fact that he's arguing on Barpada. So what Rav Moshe Kordavi explains is that Barpada's position is actually singular in nature, which is, what is the reason that when you redeem it, the kedusha comes back on the item? That's because of his opinion afterwards. His opinion afterwards says that kedusha just doesn't disappear automatically. You can't have kedusha evaporate. So that means after you cut it down, you still have to redeem it in order for the kedusha to go somewhere or disappear. So based on that, Barpada also believes that when you redeem it while it's still attached to the ground, Kedusha heichan halcha. Where did the Kedusha go to? The Kedusha, based on your nether, is still here. So how can you take it away? This doesn't evaporate. And therefore, the two are connected. When Ula disagrees and says, post the cutting, the Kedusha disappears without any problem, it does evaporate, then he will say the same thing with regards to when it's still attached to the ground. When you redeem it, the Kedusha is gone. What about your nether? Well, it goes away. Once you've redeemed it, you can remove Kedusha. And that's how Rav Moshe Kordavi explains the machloket over here. The Ran then says that that parlays into actually a nafkamina with regards to dinei mimononot. In a case where an individual says, listen, I'm gifting you my field until I go up to Yerushalayim. So then he gifts him the field, the guy takes the chazakah and he takes the field. Then he buys it back from him. He buys the gift back from him before he goes up to Yerushalayim. Can the individual who's the recipient of the gift go take it back from the original gifter, the giver, who bought it from him? Can he just take it back from him? Because he said, look, it's yours until I go up to Yerushalayim. And he hasn't gone up to Yerushalayim yet. Well, according to the Rashbo's explanation of the machloket over here, everyone agrees that before you cut the wheat down, then Choser the kedusha comes back after you redeem it. So similarly over here, after this individual now sells the field back to the original grantor of the gift, he can go then now and take it back as a gift. He says, you haven't gone to Yerushalayim yet, it's mine. And he can go back and take it back again, similar to our case by Kodshim over here, that the Kedusha returns even after you redeem it. Now the Ran clarifies that it only works by a Kinyan Kesef, where the Kinyan is still extant even after the guy buys it from you. But it's a Kinyan Chazalka disappears after that point in time, unless he uses the term Yachshav. That he uses the term Achshav, which makes the Kinyan effective today across the entirety of the span of time in which he's gifting it. So that's a technicality in Kinyanim, whether he has to use the word Ma'achshav, or whether Kesef can overcome that problem. But that's basically the Shita of the Rashba. On the other hand, the Rav Moshe Kurtavi says that that's not the case. In the case I told you over here, first of all, that that's also Machloket Ula and Bar Podo. So you'd have to paskin like Bar Podo for that to be true, because according to Ula, even when you redeem it, it doesn't go back. So too, when a guy buys the field back from you, then you can't take it back from him. The recipient of the gift can't take it back. But then the Rav Moshe Kurtavi adds on top of that, that even according to Bar Pada, it wouldn't work in the case of Dinei Mamonanot. And that is because there's a special din by Hekdesh, which is Dibor is Kimisira. You're speaking as the same validity as if you're making Kinyanim. And therefore you can effectuate Kinyanim through speech without any physical Kinyanim. And that's what gives the ability over here for the Kedusha to keep coming back, is because you made a statement. And a statement is effective in Kodashim to continue to come and come and come. But by Dinei Mamonanot, we don't have such a din. And therefore the lack of Kinyan over here, once you've used up the Kinyan the first time you received the gift, then when you go to take it back from him after he bought it back from you, that doesn't help, because you don't have a Kinyan anymore. Your Kinyanim are gone. Your whole process is starting over from scratch, and you can't reinitiate the Kinyan, because Dibur is not like Kinyan. And when he says to you, go and take this and make a chazak on this gift that he gave you the one time, he doesn't extend that to be the next time as well. And therefore, he says that the din by Dinei Mamonanot, both according to Ula, for sure, which would be that you can't take it back, but even according to Bar Pada, would not be that case. As the Ran points out, even the Rashba, in his own Perush, is somewhat skeptical as to whether the application from Kodashim would apply to Mamonanot, because exactly what Rav Moshe Kurtavi says over here, that Kodashim are different than Mamonanot, where Kodashim, Mesira or Dibur, are enough to generate the Kinyan or the obligation, whereas that is not true by Dinei Mamonanot, where you need a full-fledged Kinyan. Although he does say, if you gift something to like the Aniyim or Tzedakah, then that would have the same din as Hekdesh, as we saw earlier in the Masechta, that by Dibur, by obligations or commitments, that Tzedakah has the same din like Kodoshim, which is you don't need a Kinyan. That type of statement is obligatory and creates an obligation even without Hadpasah, and even without a Kinyan of any sort. And therefore, Nidrei Tzedakah would be similar to Nidrei Hekdesh in that aspect. Now, Rav Moshe Kurtavi brings proof to his position from the Yerushalmi, because the Yerushalmi actually over there compares a machloket between Rabbi Yochanan and Chizkiah, who argue about whether the din is podeh v'chozer or podeh by the case of our Mishnah, to the machlok between Bar Pada and Ula, which shows you that the Gemara there thinks that they are parallel in nature, and therefore Ula and Bar Pada are actually arguing not only about after the cutting, but even prior to the cutting. The exception to this rule is if a third party gets involved, and we'll see that in tomorrow's Gemara, which is only true, at least according to the Rashba, where it works maybe by Dinei Mamonanot, if the original gifter is the one who buys it back from the recipient of the gift. Then he can go back and grab it back from him. But if a third party comes in and buys the property from the recipient of the gift, or similarly in the case here of Hekdesh, if a third party comes in and his podeh redeems it, then it does not automatically go back to being Hekdesh, and also doesn't automatically go back to the recipient of the gift. Because once you enter a third party in it, Ifsake, he stops the whole process. He stops this iterative process from happening, because he's a party that's not relevant to the statements before. And the statements before can't override the third party's action over here. And that's true both by Pidyon Kodoshim, as well as by Dinei Mamonanot, according to the Rashba, who thinks that that's an extrapolation from this Din of Hekdesh. Okay, we're going to stop here on the last line of Chof Chedem Bet. And tomorrow we'll start with the question on Ula about where did the Kedusha evaporate to after he cut down the Tevuah.